This is episode 12 of the Scared to Death podcast. And my name is Katie, and I'm an undergraduate psychology major at JMU.
And my name is Eliza, and I'm also an undergraduate psychology major at JMU.
And we are here with Dr. David Reed today, and we're so excited to have you on the podcast. So thank you so much for coming out. Could you briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. I am an associate health fellow at VA Puget Sound up here in Seattle, Washington. I am part of the Health Services Research and Development, so HSR&D. And so what I do is my position is mainly research, and I'm focusing in on the whole health program that VA has. And the whole health program is really interesting in that it's trying to change really the culture of veteran care so that it is less focused, still focused, of course, on diagnostics, but it is really wanting to incorporate holistic care. So integrative care, mind-body interventions, and making sure that it really is values-based where we're focusing on what the veterans want and how they want to get better.
That's awesome. How did you get into that and become interested in that?
Yeah. So this is actually my second fellowship. My first fellowship really focused on chronic pain. And I was really interested in understanding how individuals' identities changed because of their pain, and how meaning in life potentially changed because they are dealing with this chronic illness. And then my partner, she got a position up here at the University of Washington, and Steve Zelliot, who is a researcher for VA up here in the University of Washington, he was happy to have me come on board in this particular position. And I was really interested in it because not only was it focusing in on veterans with chronic pain as well as post-traumatic stress disorder, but it was focused in on these mind-body interventions. And I really felt like these mind-body interventions were unique in that they were able to help individuals both physically and emotionally in ways that really were in line with my own perspectives around meaning in life and existential anxiety.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. So how do you think that TMT could be helpful in understanding or treating people with like mental illnesses and chronic pain and all of that? And if so, if you think it is helpful, how?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think it's helpful in a couple of different ways. For one, you know, TMT, of course, came out of Ernest Becker's work. And his ideas really were a lot about how culture is this framework by which individuals maintain their self-esteem, that they feel good about themselves, how they find meaning. So I think first off, and potentially most importantly regarding TMT, it's an excellent theoretical structure to understand why culture, relationships, religion, all of these things that we create as human beings are so important to good mental health. We know that well-being is predicated on good social relationships, on community, being validated for who you are as an individual, and allowing in a society that allows individuals to find meaning in their life. And when that happens, people feel good about themselves. Their well-being is high. Both their physical and emotional well-being is high. And so from a therapist perspective, particularly from an existential therapist perspective, I start to become acutely aware of when an individual they're participating in activities, they're in relationships, that it does not seem to bring them much meaning. And so as a therapist, it's really about finding ways to get them into positions, into activities that's going to promote that their meaning in life. And if they're promoting meaning in life, you're going to be, you're going to feel better about yourself. You're going to participate in activities that are more likely to bring you joy, to bring you happiness, positive emotions. And of course, we know that positive emotions are correlated with good mental health. And so I think that's a big way that TMT is involved with mental illness. I think another big way, and I was really talking more broadly, another potential big way is with the TMT's experimental work. So like we know, in particular, there's a couple of different researchers, Kenneth Vail and Rachel Menzies. Both of them have done a lot of great work in that intersection between terror management theory and mental health. Like Ken Vail's work around anxiety buffer disruption theory, you know, where it shows how individuals high in PTSD, and that's a population that I'm particularly interested in. So individuals high in PTSD, when they go through this horrifying experience, they struggle to use the same cultural protective factors that other individuals without PTSD do not have. And then with Dr. Menzies' work, she's focused on death anxiety as this transdiagnostic factor across different mental illnesses, which is really fascinating work. And then also with TMT, Jamie Arendt and Jamie Goldenberg came out with the TMT health model a while ago, and it really describes how individuals will do things that aren't necessarily good for their health, or they'll avoid doctor appointments. They'll avoid these things that may be good for them because the trade-off is that they in the short term they're going to feel good about themselves. And so that's another really interesting way that terror management theory intersects with mental health. So I do think it has a lot to say about that.
Along with what you were just saying about how some people do things that may not always benefit their health, how do you think that TMT is helpful for people, and or do you think it's helpful for people in the general public to have knowledge about it and how that would impact their decision making?
Yeah, great question. I remember going down to, when I was down in Texas, my first fellowship was in San Antonio, and I went to Texas A&M, which is not too far away from there, and visited with Josh Hicks and Becca Schlegel and Matt Vess. They have an existential center there. Their program really focuses on that stuff. And I remember being in a conversation with Dr. Schlegel, and she asked, you know, sometimes I wonder, is this just some construct that intellectual study in order, and you know, that it doesn't really have a whole lot of purpose. It's not really actually helping people. My response to that was I think it is important. And, you know, of course, individuals don't need to know about this stuff in order to feel good or to improve their mental health. However, it's interesting when these topics are brought up, when you talk to people or introduce the idea of terror management theory and the different hypotheses and the different tenets of terror management theory, they connect with it. They immediately at this gut level understand what you're talking about. And I believe because I think it does ring true for a lot of people. We're talking with terror management theory, a lot of the tenets of terror management theory, that culture is important, that maintaining one's self-esteem is important, and you get that through relationships and your community, and those things that resonates with a lot of people. And so I think in a broad sense, educating people about terror management theory, I think it brings them closer to what it means to be human. Like, it brings them closer to who they are as individuals. It makes them reflect more. And I think generally reflecting more, having more self-awareness is a good thing. And that's going to improve mental health.
Yeah, that's awesome. And speaking about what it means to be human, what do you feel like it means to be human, and how does TMT kind of fit with this definition?
Yeah, you're putting that question back on me, aren't you? Because I ask people on that on my podcast. Great question. I've thought about this, and you could go multiple different ways with this. However, I've kind of landed on this idea, and I'm sure that philosophical, more minded people could tear this apart, and that's okay. But I think it's to be human is to change, and to be aware that you're changing. And what I mean by that is with being human, we are constantly changing. And terror management theory, if you really think about it, it's a theory about change, because we are going to change from individuals who are living to individuals who are not living. Life is finite. We live, we love, we die. And so when individuals talk about, when individuals think about what it means to be human, when they think about these ideas, I think it connects them more with themselves. And people are going to grow, people are going to change. You know, I think about this particular, interview and think about change. Like I've been changing throughout this interview. We all have, right? Like I am a different person now than I was several minutes ago. I did not, I had not met you before this particular interview. So now we're different. So being a human is constant change. However, we also know that we are changing, and that's what the terror is about, right? Like we have to deal with that change, and we have to deal with the ultimate change of dying.
Going back to your discussion with Dr. Rachel Menzies in episode 2 of your podcast, I really enjoyed that one. And I enjoyed how she brought up that, as we know, humans are the only species that are aware of their own death. And right, along with what it means to be human, I really enjoyed the question. So I'm just going to ask this right back to you of, how do you manage your own death anxiety?
Yeah. Yeah. I manage it by, I think a lot of what I do is very much wrapped up in my own symbolic immortality. Like I think there's some good aspects to this, there are some not so good aspects to this, but I think I really am driven by wanting to make an important and deep impact on the world and leave it in a better place than I showed up here with it. And so I think that is something that underlies a lot of the decisions that I make. And I feel like that is certainly something, a way that I am managing my death anxiety. I think I intellectualize a lot. Like I think that uncertainty around it. I grew up religious. And so I grew up religious in the South. And so when you grow up religious in the South, that often stays with you. And so you're taught from a very young age that this is what happens when you die. And that we know that there are certain things you need to do in order to make sure that you're going to live forever, and go to heaven. Now, I'm no longer religious. However, that uncertainty, that wanting an answer and explanations has stuck with me. And I think that's one of the reasons why I study this stuff, honestly, is because that's a question in the back of my head consistently. And it has been for such a long time. And when I went to school, when I went to graduate school, I thought that what I wanted to do was study religion. Like I wanted to be a therapist and I wanted to study religion. And in fact, that's not really what I wanted to study. What I wanted to study was why people believe the things that they do, and why people make the decisions that they do. And so I guess that's a couple of different ways that I manage my death anxiety. It's the symbolic immortality is a huge piece of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Speaking about kind of your what your research interests are, what are your future plans for research in relation to TMT and existential psychology?
Yeah, so my research broadly focuses on co-occurring mental and physical health conditions. So much of my work specifically is focused in on co-occurring pain and PTSD, and that's a lot of what my writing is about. And there's my research program that I'm really trying to developing is along two different lines. One line of thinking is around the idea of existential self-regulation. So among individuals with co-occurring pain and PTSD, how does improvement in existential anxiety, so the meaning in life, isolation, freedom, death anxiety, how do improvements across those constructs map on to correlate with, predict physical and emotional well-being? So that's very kind of individual focus, an individualized way of looking at the research. But then there's also another line of thinking with my research that really this what my current position is really focused in on, and I'm learning a whole lot about it because it's stuff I really didn't know before I came here, and that's around how do we change systems of care and treatments to include those particular themes. And I think that's one of the things that draws me to VA, to whole health, is because here we have this massive system that is taking care of so many individuals. And many of these individuals struggle with both physical and mental health conditions. And not everybody wants to take medication. Not everybody wants to go to individual therapy and to talk to somebody once a week for an hour. Some people want to see chaplains. Some people want to go to groups with other veterans and talk about their faith, talk about their spiritualness, and whole health that allows that. And so I'm really interested in not only at an individual level, how do these things map onto well-being, but also at a systems level, how do we change systems, not only VA, but other, you know, in the private sector, how do we change these systems to make sure that people are getting the services that they need that's going to fulfill all these different life domains that oftentimes just kind of go neglected, because as psychologists, psychiatrists, we kind of feel like, oh, this isn't in our realm. We need to stay in our lane, which is more mental health. And I argue that's spirituality, faith, that those are things that are very much in our lane. You know, spirituality, religion, faith, those things are the next step when we think about like social relationships. Like psychologists are developing interventions that improve social relationships. And it seems like to me, like another piece of this is to have interventions available to people, whether or not it's faith-based or whether or not it is secular, but brings in their faith, that's going to focus in on those elements of their care.
With the idea of the whole health package and just caring, especially with how different countries have responded to COVID-19 and the level of anxiety and self-protections that people have taken, which countries do you feel like could catch on to this idea, and maybe how long it would take to start seeing this?
I think that a lot of, so I am pretty sure that over in England, they have their national healthcare system. And I'm relatively certain that they have programs in place that focus on these ideas. So I don't think that, this idea is necessarily, foreign to a lot of different places, a lot of different countries. I think that it certainly has been foreign with the United States because of how psychologists that particular profession has formed, and it really seemed like it wanted to get away from any type of religious notions. any spiritual notions and wanted to be a science, you know? And so that's fantastic and all that, that you want to be scientific. That's super important. You know, it should be empirical. At the same time, I don't think that we need to necessarily let go of focusing in on some of these things. I mean, it's important, like whether or not me or you are religious, the psychologist is religious. I mean, what, like 92% of people in America are religious or spiritual. And so like this, like it's clearly something that is part of society. It's clearly something that is part of health and mental health. So it just seems like a natural fit to focus on those things in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. So steering back a little bit to some TMT and how you got interested in it. So I was just wondering like how you learned about TMT and kind of what has made you like stay interested in it like throughout your work.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, I probably have a story similar to many people. I first heard about it in graduate school first year and I read Ernest Becker's Denial of Death. And I was just blown away by the ideas. It just made sense to me. I felt like I really connected with a lot of the things that he was saying. Going back to what I was saying earlier, like looking for, as someone who let religion go, there's still kind of this pull for me to find a nice framework that all of these ideas can fit in. And Ernest Becker kind of provided that for me. I have a feeling that that's a lot of individuals when they read Becker, that's very similar aspects. I read that book, and also I was writing a paper my first year of graduate school, and I happened upon Ken Vail's 2010 paper that explained, kind of goes along the same lines, it explained religion and the fact that we have religion from a terror management theory perspective. And then that's when my mind was blown, and I was just like, this is exactly like what I am interested in, what I want to study. And so that really started my path down this wanting to know more about terror management theory specifically, and going to figure out ways to think about it in my own work. Honestly, reflecting back on it, it's been a bit difficult to keep that thread in my work. And the reason that is because, you know, in clinical work, terror management theory isn't necessarily something that people talk about. I'm in research. You get funded in research by applying to grants from whether it's the NSF, NIH, Robert Wood Johnson, you know, private sector, you know, all these different things. And a lot of the times, you know, these ideas aren't the top of their priority for funding. It's definitely been something for me to figure out ways to look at these, and it's actually helped me think a lot better about this stuff, but to look at terror management theory, to look at existential anxiety more broadly in a way that's going to inform care, that's going to inform mental health, and really find ways to intersect these things so that I can continue to do both, because I love talking about this stuff. I love focusing in on this stuff. And so it's really been a challenge for me to intersect these things in a way that people who have zero interest in this stuff can relate to. And so I think that's been certainly a challenge, but it's also, again, it's helped me think about these things in a different way.
The whole connection between religion and TMT, I find very interesting, and how religiousness can help in relieving death anxiety. But on the other end of the spectrum, do you think that there's a point where maybe over-religiousness or religiousness could affect how that could maybe negatively affect death anxiety?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And if you think about, religion and the functions of religion and what that does, you know, one aspect of it is the symbolic immortality, right? Like you as an individual with religion, you know where you're going to go after you die. And so there are certain things to navigate that. So that's more of the literal immortality aspect. So your body is going to die, but your soul is going to live on. And then there's a symbolic immortality component to it, where by being a good religious person, by being a nice member of the church, then you are providing yourself self-esteem, which is going to give you the illusion that you're going to be remembered forever through your church. And so at the extremes of both of those things, and I want to make this clear too, like I think that we were talking about religion, but we could also talk about other aspects of how we group, how individuals group themselves in society. But with religion specifically, you know, you individuals could certainly dive in, be inflexible about their opinions, their views, and then they are derogating other groups, right? There's a whole bunch of TMT research that talks about, you know, looking down on other groups, derogating other groups, punishing people more that don't believe in your ideas. I mean, religion is a framework of beliefs. And so at the extreme levels, individuals just start to dehumanize other individuals. And I think that happens in religion, it happens in politics, it happens in many ways that we view ourselves. So I do think that there's a danger to that. And a lot of it goes back to in how to deal with that is around flexibility. Like even in mental health, the idea of cognitive flexibility, being able to change the way you think about things in order to incorporate new information, is super important for mental health. And I think it could be the same for religious ideas, where rigidity is not necessarily, and pure belief is not necessarily the way to go. And it's really about allowing yourself to have doubt in certain moments, so that you can, you know, open yourself up and deconstruct those thoughts.
That's awesome. It's really interesting to hear about like religion and the way it impacts people and their death anxiety. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about Yalom's four existential givens, and which four of the givens do you think people today need the most help in coping with their death anxiety? And yeah.
So with Yalom's, and this is it's interesting you bring this up. I decided with my own podcast, I wanted to, the first four episodes, I wanted to provide a language around this, because so many times, like, you talk to people about whatever it is, and there's just this different language around it. So I wanted to really talk about these four constructs, and meaning in life. Start off with that one, of course, is believing you have a purpose, believing you have a sense as you're going through life, that you feel significant, that you feel as if you're making an impact on the world. With existential isolation, it's the idea that your reality, your shared reality, is different from other people. Somehow you feel different as an individual. With death anxiety, it's less about how you're going to die, and it's more about just this anxiety, this terror, this fear of death, and what's going to happen after the fact that we're going to no longer exist. And then finally, freedom, which is, in my opinion, it's the most difficult to explain, freedom, because it's not like political freedom where you are, you know, you're allowed to do as you want, you know, in whatever country you're in, how we think about freedom in the United States. But it's more about self-actualization and becoming who you want to be as an individual, and allowing yourself to be free, and to be authentic, and to have autonomy over your own decisions. And gosh, what's the four that most of the people need to work on? You know, I really don't know the answer to that question. I will say, however, that meaning in life really seems to be this, in many ways, the result of a lot of the other anxieties. Like if you feel like you have a good grasp on what's going to happen to you after you die, or you accept it in a certain way, if you accept or you're good with your shared reality with others, if you have a sense of autonomy, authenticity, your life is going to have meaning. Like you're going to feel like you have meaning in life. And we know that the focus on trying to be happy as people, like especially in, you know, the Western society, like consumerism, and let's all be happy, and let's, you know, hedonism, let's just do what makes us feel good. That's not necessarily a long-term solution. And the long-term solution is more in finding meaning in life. And Clay Routledge has done a lot of good work around meaning in life. So if I had to give you an answer, I'm going with meaning in life. If people focus more on finding purpose, finding activities, finding, you know, relationships that they give their life meaning, then they're going to have a better quality of life.
Okay, last question, and maybe the toughest question. I'm interested in hearing, when you're undergrad or graduate studies, what was your favorite psychology class that you've taken?
Wow, favorite psychology class. Oh, I'm gonna have to think back. Let's see. Favorite psychology class that I took. Wow. You know, I really got into statistics and psychology. However, it wasn't until after I got done with that. So my first advisor was Dr. Nigel Field, and he actually passed away while I was in graduate school. But our first year of graduate school, everyone had to take two of these classes, and it was cognitive and affective bases of behavior, and how we taught the class, and the fact that I had been out of school for a while, and so I was getting back into school, I was understanding these particular psychology, and the fact that I was understanding, oh wait a second, like how you think about things affects how you feel, and that affects your behaviors, and all these things are interrelated in some way. And how you feel affects what you think about something. Like that really resonated with me. That was something that I was really super excited about and interested in. And in another life, maybe I'm a cognitive psychologist, you know, focused in on consciousness or something like that. But this idea that if someone is depressed or someone's mood is not, someone's feeling negative in that moment, and they hear something or they view something, that their interpretation of that is going to be negative. More likely to be negative. Like maybe I should have known that as a first year graduate student. I probably should have, but I did not. And I think that kind of blew my mind. And so understanding, hearing him talk, and I really enjoyed how he talked about things. And so I would have to say that one of those two classes were probably my favorites. And I think maybe the second, it was two different classes. And the second one, we held different study groups, and I felt like that me as somebody who had really a lack of confidence, and I felt really insecure going into graduate school about what I knew, what I should know. Hell, that still happens to me to this day with currently. But going into graduate school, I really felt it. And his class was one of the ways through which I started to connect things, and I started to feel confident about, oh, like I can do this stuff. This makes sense to me. I can teach it to other people. So I'm going to go with cognitive affective basis of behavior with Dr. Field during my first year.
That's awesome. It makes me want to take that class too. It seems like really awesome. But we just want to thank you so much for coming today and taking the time to talk with us. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Oh yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you bringing me on and having an opportunity to talk about these ideas that I enjoy talking about.
Thank you again, Dr. Reed, and thank you, the listener, for joining us today here on the Scared to Death podcast.